How do you go from selling lizards online to raising $15 million for a debit card for college kids? I'm Zane Sabag, and on today's episode of Appreneurs, I'll tell you the story of Scott Smith, founder of Fizz. All right, thanks so much for being here, Scott. Could you tell us a bit about what you're building and why you're building it?
Yeah, so I'm building a company called Fizz, started 3 years ago with my co-founder, Carlo. We make a credit building debit card for college students and a financial adulting platform for Gen Z. We're building Fizz because for too long, Gen Z has felt locked out of the financial adulting ecosystem. That means that they were unable to get credit cards. They were unable to apply for loans. People really feel like they're starting out adulthood without a strong path to having agency over their personal finances. So we're creating products to give them that agency.
How do you feel about building this environment where buy now, pay later products are all the rage, like Klarna, all those things?
Buy now, pay later is actually very interesting to us. So one thing that we like to point to is that college students and Gen Z college students specifically have this sort of antagonism towards credit cards, but not so much to credit. And that's really evident in their usage of buy now, pay later services like Affirm, Klarna, Afterpay, what have you. So it's really just about the packaging, the transparency, and how you're actually presenting that credit to them.
And how do you guys present that credit to them?
So the way that the Fizz card actually works is it's a credit building debit card. So essentially it is a line of credit that you access via a debit card. So when you go to make a purchase with our card, we spot you for that purchase. Then you pay us back at the end of the day. So say during a day you made 10 or 15 purchases. All those purchases are then bundled into one daily auto payment that you pay back. So the way that Fizz extends credit is on a daily cadence instead of a monthly cadence, such that students aren't racking up a large monthly bill that they at the end of the month are going to have no idea how they're going to pay up.
So if the students go beyond their daily limit or what they're able to pay, they just can't spend money the next day on that card.
That's correct. So we give them a daily recommended available to spend. It's something that we developed. It's essentially like a layer below their credit limit. And what this does is it tells the student, okay, this is how much Fizz's algorithm thinks that you should be spending, rather than just sort of like leaving it all to them and leaving it to a case where they might overspend.
Could you walk us through some of the personal testimonies that made you know that what you're building is super needed?
Yes. One thing that's pretty funny is if you go to a college campus and you sit down at any cafe, you can see students buying coffee or maybe they're buying lunch. Oftentimes what people do, and this is something that we saw our friends doing on campus, is they will log into the payment portal for their credit card. And they will pay off exactly the amount of the purchase they just made off of their credit card so that it doesn't like contribute to their monthly statement balance. So that, for example, was one of the behaviors that we observed that compelled us to create the daily auto pay functionality. If students are so worried about racking up not only like a bill, but an interest-bearing one, that they're manually paying off transactions one by one, why not automatically bundle all their daily transactions into one auto payment?
Makes sense. So I read that you dropped out of college at 21. And could you walk us through your childhood and what came before that, what led up to that?
Yeah, my dad has still never worked for anyone else. And when my little brother, who's a year younger than me, was born, my mom actually left her corporate job to start her own businesses as well. I grew up in the Detroit, Michigan area. My parents were running multiple businesses. I'd like to say that I probably learned more just like being in their shadow than I ever learned in school. So I was always thinking about, okay, what's something I can do on the side? That led to me starting a number of lemonade stand-ish businesses as a kid. So one, during the financial crisis, I started a business helping defunct business owners get rid of their excess inventory and assets. So I was essentially like putting their stuff on auction websites, but they didn't really know how to do that. As a kid did. So I was grossing quite a bit more money than I would have ever expected to be making in like elementary and middle school doing that. So that was pretty fun. That was my first entree. Second, I started a business selling snakes online, one and helping snake breeders sell their snakes online. So I'd always wanted like a pet snake, but my parents wouldn't let me have one. So I would go around to all these reptile conferences in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, pass out business cards and offer to make people websites and help them set up e-commerce stores. Didn't last super long because I got shut down, but that's a story for another time. But yeah, so grew up starting all sorts of things and then sort of one day knew off in the distance that I would want to start my own thing.
I'd really love to hear more about the story of getting shut down in the reptile business.
But actually, I'm trying to think what I can actually say about that.
Whatever you're legally allowed to say.
Whatever I'm legally allowed to say. Essentially, I would recommend to all youth out there, do not try to sell live animals online without a permit. You will probably get shut down by your state's Department of Agriculture. Learn that the hard way.
Great. How'd you meet your co-founder?
Carlo and I actually met. We were doing an internship together. His freshman year at Harvard, my sophomore year at Cornell, we were actually scouting for a VC fund remotely. Internship didn't last super long, but it was right before COVID. And he was one of the people who was on my shoulder when the pandemic first hit, telling me to stop paying tuition to do school out of my childhood bedroom. And eventually one day I listened and we decided to start something together.
So he was out of school before that?
He had made the decision to take a leave of absence earlier than most. I was considering it at the time. It wasn't super popular among my friend group at school, but he convinced me to take the jump. And for context, Carlo, my co-founder, was an international student from Germany. So he was doing, you know, Harvard on Central European time. So it just made even less sense than me doing Cornell on Eastern time from my childhood bedroom in Detroit. So I ended up actually flying over to Germany just to work with him and my other two co-founders during the pandemic.
You guys were working out of Germany?
Yeah. So we rented the cheapest possible apartment in almost all of Berlin. We were four people and then it became five people splitting a one bedroom apartment above an old bunker in Wedding. We were working on a different idea before Fizz, but it was kind of like our little Berlin hacker house for the summer.
So everybody in the group was technical, all hacking together?
We were about 50% technical, 50% sales, as we call it, but all hacking together for sure. We had pretty much nothing else to do as the entire city was shut down during lockdown. So there was nothing to do but work on our ideas.
And what was the first idea?
So the first idea was company called ShoulderTap. So we were building chat-based knowledge management for large companies. So we would index a company's Slack, Microsoft Teams, Google Drive, internal cloud email so that they could query their own internal expertise. Oftentimes, someone will start a new job or shift into a new role at a large company, and there's a lot of context that they just don't have. And that context lives mostly buried in email, Slack messages, that sort of thing. So what we would do is similar to, you can kind of think of like a chat GPT-based interface nowadays, but it was like that internally, but for companies.
And why'd you guys pivot away from this space? It strikes me that there's a lot of really successful companies doing that a couple of years down the line.
Yes. I think for us, that was sort of how we learned the importance of timing. I think we were very passionate about the idea. We'd been working on it for a while. We had a few large pilot agreements signed with some pretty cool companies. But I think now there's a lot of people are using LLMs to accomplish what we were doing from scratch with our own transformer models. And then also the category just wasn't, this is shocking to hear that in 2021, this sort of product wasn't super investable. Not that that's the only proxy that matters, but so two things. One, the tech now, just 3 short years later, is a bit easier to create. So timing. And then two, the promise that four college kids would sort of stay true to having dropped out of Stanford, Harvard, and Cornell to do that was not believable from the investor base as the same kids dropping out to build a debit card that builds credit for college students or Gen Z.
Next out, can you tell us about applying to YC and what that was like?
Let me see if I can remember. So we actually applied to YC twice. I think there's now a saying that floats around in the YC community that the second time is the charm when it comes to YC applications. But so we applied sort of on a whim the first time. The second time we were a bit more intentional about it. We had a history of doing a bunch of pitch competitions and stuff. So we sort of just crushed to fill out the application, created a demo and recorded the video interview. We had the interview. We're pretty convinced we would not get in because the YC partners were actually asking us during the 10-minute interview about what we would pivot to if we got in. But then we were lucky enough to get the call, had a second interview with them, and they accepted us. So we were the second ever remote batch. We were in the summer 2021 class of YC.
Most people don't get a second interview.
They might kill me for disclosing this, but people know about the second interview, right? Like this is like public knowledge, right? Okay,
cool. I'd read it.
The second interview was a bit more incisive than the first. I think after each YC interview, one of the partners on the call specifically will know exactly what they want to dig into just because of the pattern match. And for us, it was actually just about whether or not this was a company that we wanted to keep building. I think they had had some awareness based off our application and the first interview that we had, other ideas that they had theses around or found compelling. They had also seen people attempt to build what we were promising to build at the time, which was ShoulderTap. And they were sort of aware of the common pitfalls there. So that was them digging into, okay, why is our approach more unique and a bit more into the demonstrated traction?
So you got in with ShoulderTap and then pivoted to Fizz.
That's correct. Yep. So we got in with ShoulderTap, pivoted about halfway through the batch to Fizz. I think the reason why we ended up really pivoting from ShoulderTap to Fizz was just that while we were, from a technical point of view, really, really passionate about the tech that we were creating at ShoulderTap, I think that Fizz was just sort of an impact thing. There are not a lot of double bottom line ideas that we had on our idea sheet. And we were thinking, okay, is it ShoulderTap versus something else? This is very intimate to us. It's a problem that all of our friends, regardless of their economic background, experienced in some way or another. It was something that we felt it was a hair on problem fire for us rather than a hair on fire problem for someone else. Us having just like been a few college kids who didn't have a ton of experience working for the types of companies who might have consumed the software solution we were creating with ShoulderTap. So for us, it was like, okay, this was, it just felt obvious. Like it viscerally felt like this was the product that we needed to create.
What do you think are other double bottom line spaces for college kids specifically?
I think that's an interesting question. And of course, my mind goes a lot to like all the tangentially finance related ones. I think that anything that sort of helps students command this agency that at large, I think is felt to be lacking, can be a double bottom line position. What I mean by that is like, there's this sort of stereotype nowadays that college students are sort of listless. They're just floating around. They don't necessarily like this generation, for example, is sort of, there are ascriptions made that were like the whole snowflake thing, for example. I think like when you really talk to students, and what it really boils down to is they just feel like the world has changed and is changing in fundamental ways that mean that when they do exit college and enter adulthood, there's just less that they can actually do to control where their life's direction goes. So in terms of double bottom line, I think a business like Handshake is one that we like to point to, but you're giving students actionable tools that they wouldn't have otherwise had to be able to control their career direction, for example, and you're making a lot of money doing that. So I think that any business where you're giving a student actionable steps and tools that they otherwise wouldn't have had to control their own destiny, rather than feeling like they're just subject to the whims of the world, can be a double bottom line business for college students.
Good answer. Could you walk us through the early days of building Fizz and switching, pivoting? Do you guys feel anxious that you were pivoting so late into the YC batch?
I think we were a bit anxious about our late stage pivot, but it was super exciting nonetheless. The first thing we did was we called everyone we knew. So I think we did probably 100 pretty unstructured user interviews. And I think it was 36 hours between my co-founders and I. We literally called everyone we knew at Cornell, Harvard, and Stanford, and we were asking them all sorts of questions about their experiences with credit building, with credit cards specifically. This was sort of in the stage where we're still trying to get conviction that this is exactly the thing that we wanted to build, just because there's an obvious opportunity cost there, having been halfway through the YC batch. So that was the first thing we did. The second thing we did is we're like, okay, how the hell do we actually launch a financial product? I think at the time we benefited from a lot of naivete. Probably this was in August of 2021. We were in the batch thinking that we were going to be able to launch the cart in October. Now, retrospectively, a 2-month timeline to launch any financial product, let alone a more novel one. Ambitious to the point of like, okay, guys, this is going to be impossible. Thankfully, we didn't know that at the time. So I think immediately after doing the user interviews, we started building a wait list. We put together a landing page, which I cringe when I look at now, and started getting some signups at a lot of schools, which was super cool as well. But then we figured out, okay, we have to figure out how to actually launch this financial product. So we started the necessary partnerships work and started putting together a demo app as well.
Would you say a lot of your growth on the waitlist was organic, or were you guys really pushing the early signups?
Yeah, so a lot of our waitlist growth was organic. And I love to talk about waitlists there. There's definitely a lot of lore there. And I think there needs to be even more lore. We drew up this waitlist organically. We shared it with friends. I think we had built in referral mechanism to the waitlist early on, where you could refer a friend to move up the waitlist. So in the beginning, it was just mostly our friends at our schools. And then they started referring their friends at other schools, and it grew from there. We never really spent any money growing the waitlist. And this waitlist ended up existing for about 2 years. I think at one point we did like an AirPods giveaway or something like that. But the waitlist did grow organically over the course of those 2 years.
So what did it hit at the end of the 2 years?
I think at the end of 2 years, we were around 50,000 students, if I'm remembering correctly. Now, knowing what I know about waitlists, there's a half-life when it comes to waitlist conversion for sure. And there's a lot of tips and tricks. We've now done a few other waitlists. Like sometimes when we're growing too fast, we have to implement a waitlist now. And knowing what we know now, we know how to get those users to convert it at super high rates. But before, there's a magic to waitlist that must be honed.
So can you tell us a little bit about that magic? What are your tips and tricks that you're allowed to share? Non-company IP.
Yes. I think that the waitlists can and should be interactive. I think that a lot of times companies think of them as like mailing lists or email lists. Instead, I think that they should be action-based. So obviously there are a lot of companies who've pioneered this pretty publicly now, such as Robinhood has done a great job of this. But from everything from like refer to move up the waitlist mechanisms to taking micro actions to accrue something for when you get off the waitlist. So what I mean by that is, okay, say you're waiting on the waitlist. If you take a screenshot of your waitlist position and post it on your Instagram story, we will give you like 100 points when you eventually sign up for the product. So that something being like really intentional about making the waitlist active instead of passive can have dramatic impacts on how it eventually converts.
How successfully were you able to grow those conversion rates? Where'd you start and where'd you end?
So our original waitlist, and there are a bunch of confounding variables here, just because it was a 2 years long waitlist, didn't convert super highly at all. I think we were pretty disappointed with the eventual conversion rate of that. It had about like 50K students on it, to the point where I don't even actually know the rate. I think when we eventually launched, we were lucky that the floodgates sort of opened and many people had just sort of been watching who were on the waitlist who then signed up anyway. So it didn't end up mattering. But later when we had a waitlist, for example, most recently in quarter one of this year, 2024, we converted almost 90% of the waitlist. So pretty dramatic difference from a non-measurable percent to over 90%.
Could you tell us a little bit more about these explosive growth episodes you guys have been having lately? I saw that you guys were like racking as many signups over a weekend as you were over 3 months or so.
Yes. So for us, what we discovered is that referrals are super important for college students. And referrals are pretty interesting when it comes to a financial product as well. Specifically, if you think about building credit in college, what's a student going to do when they're going to look for a card? Sure, they're going to like search TikTok. They're going to search Google pretty obviously. But what they then do next is they ask upperclassmen, they ask their TA, they may ask a sibling who's a bit older, they ask their peers. So referral behavior is pretty well baked into at least when you get your first independently chosen financial product. People are coming in and they have no credit whatsoever. So 6 to 8 months later, they are going from credit invisible to suddenly having a really good credit score on average. So when that happens, we saw that users started to refer at 5 times the rate of people who hadn't seen their credit score yet. So we unveiled a referral mechanism that specifically targeted at that moment. So when someone revealed their credit score for the first time, we then sent them a push notification that says, okay, earn up to $200 for referring a friend. The user and their friend could earn a variable referral bonus of up to $200 each time someone made a successful referral. So that's why over the 6 months between November of last year and spring of this year, we saw pretty explosive growth is because of tying in that referral program to this homogenous user journey that we'd observed.
So what does up to $200 mean?
Up to $200. So you can think of it kind of like a free stock promotion with Robinhood, if you will. I know, for example, the first time I ever used that, I referred my little brother and I got $175 worth of Apple stock. So then, of course, I became Robinhood's best referrer ever. So I won't say that we reinvented the wheel with this mechanism. It kind of replicates that, except instead of giving away stock, giving away cold hard cash.
And why do you think some companies like Temu are super unsuccessful with that?
I think it's interesting because referrals are weird. If we step outside of like the builder mindset and we think about like when like you and I, for example, have actually referred users to products, even products that we love, I think that actually more so like doing a literal referral, meaning sharing your code or link with someone, asking them to input your code or make sure they use your link, it's completely different than actually word of mouth sharing. It's because there's a sort of self-interest that's baked into it. So I think a lot of times when referral programs are otherwise fully baked, the reasons why they may not work is because they don't figure out how to get people over this selfish hump of like, okay, I'm referring something to you, but I obviously get something out of this. And what we did is we found creative ways to get over that hump.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So we took a pretty heavy-handed approach, actually. So we had our social team created some videos talking about, here's how you explain Fizz to a friend. And the language in that centered around why credit building itself was actually necessary in college. So it didn't really focus on the monetary bonus that you would get for a referral. It focused on sort of like, this is an altruistic thing that I'm offering you of a lot of products, but even down to like the default referral language that comes up in an app on the share sheet when you're like, okay, share a referral link with someone. We focused a lot on that language. We A/B tested the hell out of it until we got it to the point where when people received this text message, they didn't just like automatically ignore it. So I think that companies could afford to get a lot more creative there. And even us, we have a bit more work to do for sure.
Awesome. I'm going to ask you the question that I'm sure is on everyone's mind. How are you guys making money?
That is a great question. No, we make money like conventional card companies do. Until recently, our revenue was almost entirely interchange based. This is a pretty simple concept. Whenever you swipe a card at any merchant, they pay effectively a small percentage of that transaction for the ability to accept cards. That percentage is a bit higher for credit cards because in theory, someone making a purchase on credit is spending a larger amount of money than they otherwise might have made if they spent it on debit, because credit gives you the option to extend your own personal balance sheet. So it's a variable percentage, roughly between 1 and sometimes 2.5%, if you want to think about it very simplistically. So then obviously it becomes a scale game. If you're making only a very, you can then logically say that you have to grow volume pretty substantially to make significant revenues. But that is how a lot of transactional businesses start in the beginning. It's very much a long-term game, specifically with college students. For us though, we have the interchange revenue line. We also launched subscriptions a few months back. So we have subscription revenues, interchange revenues, and soon we will have affiliate revenues as well.
So what do your subscription revenues include? What do they offer you?
Yes. So subscriptions for us, so the Fizz card is completely free. Building credit with Fizz is free. There is, though, a version of the app that you can get that comes with additional features. So those are financial literacy courses on everything from budgeting to investing to savings, credit, and more. But with Fizz Premium, which is what our subscription is called, you unlock even more courses. We have a proactive budgeting solution that gets a bit more detailed when you have the subscription as well. We have advanced credit monitoring that you can subscribe to. Obviously, every Fizz user can see their credit score for free. But with advanced credit monitoring, you get special credit milestones. The credit building experience is a bit more gamified as well. And then there's a few features that you get in addition with the subscription. And so far, users are loving it. We only launched it in May, but I think we're super happy with the performance of that out of the gate.
And how do you see the subscription conversions faring so far?
So far, 11.5% of new users do opt into Fizz Premium subscription. So that's a stat that we're super happy about. I think one interesting thing for us is that benchmarking can be a bit difficult. So we're really only comparing ourselves to ourselves last month. So hopefully we can sort of see where that asymptotes out. But 11.5% of new users subscribe to Fizz subscription.
Incredible. That is an incredible conversion rate. Wow. So do you think subscriptions and credit card fees are the end game for Fizz? Are you going to push this to the moon? Or do you have any other financial products in mind?
I think there are ways where I think we want to be a bit more creative. And what I mean by that is I think in some ways, cyclically, we are constructing Fizz in a sort of like a feet first way, at least as compared to how larger, already successful fintechs like the Chimes of the world built their businesses. You know, there's a world in which we would have gone fully distribution first and not had so much of a scientific focus as we currently do on improving the average revenue per user profiles. But do I think that subscriptions and interchange of the entry are the end game? Absolutely not. I think that on our roadmap, we have visions for introducing some pretty novel financial products, a conventional lending business income statement. That said, I think there's opportunity for us to build a really well-performing business that cash flows probably better than a comparable fintech, at least at the same stage, just based off of those subscription revenues. Sure. I think what becomes super important for us is that Fizz is not necessarily just a financial technology company. I think we're a financial adulting platform, and even beyond that, an adulting platform at large. There are a lot of services that we can advise college students on. We get a lot of customer support inbound. Like, people send us tickets about everything you'd expect them to send customer support tickets about. But one thing that's pretty interesting is that they ask us for sort of this life and adulting advice. There are all these sorts of questions about, okay, like, which one of these internship options should I take? Like, which, like, where do you think I should go after college? People are essentially talking to our customer support agents as if they were like a counselor, or sometimes like an upperclassman even, or just like a friend that the student doesn't have. And what that allows us to do is determine, or like what we took away from that was that, okay, there's this opportunity to guide them in all sorts of decisions that may not just be related to their bank account and their wallet. So I think that Fizz becomes a platform beyond just the core financial technology. And what that allows us to do at scale, at least, is we think to be able to nail the cross-sell. So you look at the income statement of the Credit Karmas of the world, and you look at the margins of the Credit Karmas of the world as compared to purely transactional businesses. I think over time, we get to sort of like a chimeric hybrid of those sorts of two worlds.
An awesome vision. I think what's super interesting is I know a lot of people that have tried to build this second product that you're talking about, advising people. But I think it's really interesting. You're positioning yourself almost as a figure of authority. And then that trust in you as their card provider enables them to actually ask those questions and be willing to listen and reach out. Amazing.
No, I mean, we're super excited about it. I think we had a hell of a lot of time to think about the business before we're actually live, just because it took a bit longer than we expected to be able to launch Fizz. And what that enabled us to do is to have a very close community with our audience. So we built a huge social media presence before we were ever actually live. And we would get 3,000 comments a day, people being like, okay, when is the Fizz card actually going to drop? Like, is this real? Is this even legit? But besides that sort of thing, people just told us exactly what they wanted without us having to ask. There's product wisdom that says, okay, sometimes your users don't actually need exactly what they're telling you that they want, but you can sort of take the average and on a meta level, at least gives you like a directional sense of what you should be building, which is why we have had this platform vision since day one.
Just for all the listeners out there, Scott's raised one of the, perhaps the most iconic rounds in consumer over the last few years, $14.4 million, I think, from some top investors. Could you walk us through how you did that and how you decided it was the right time?
So we're lucky enough. Kleiner Perkins led our seed round. Ilya Fishman there just joined our board. We just announced the seed round a few weeks back. I think fundraising for us has been a super interesting journey. Obviously, we went through YC back in 2021. Building a fintech is very expensive. That's something we didn't necessarily No, at the time, I think if we had known how much money we were going to spend on lawyers, for example, we spent a larger share of the seed round than I'm comfortable sharing just on legal expenses to compliantly launch the product. We're a very, very compliant organization. I think there are a lot of stories out there that show what happens when fintechs and fintech partners don't have as much of an emphasis on compliance as we do. Super expensive. So a fundraising to us was an interesting journey because as I just mentioned, if we had known how much money it was going to cost, we probably would have raised even more. I think that for us, the journey was just finding people who had been party to early stage fintech journeys. It's a bit like a different category of investing. Obviously, with the Kleiner Perkins team and with Ilya specifically, there was a bit of an intersection because they've been early partners on Robinhood's journey as well. So they've sort of seen some of the pitfalls there and how capitalization differs. Also, in terms of our angel investors who came on board during the round, it was really important to find people who could advise us. Okay, we have no experience building a financial technology company. It's like really complex. We just learned this. Like, how did you do it when you were the third employee at Revolut, for example? So we were lucky enough to be able to build a cabinet of highly specialized angels, even sometimes more so than the funds. And that's, I think, how we were able to sort of survive the fintech winter and come out, at least maybe not on the other side, but when there's a little bit of sun peeking through the clouds, having closed the larger seed round.
What's your approach to hiring?
So we have a fuck yes approach to hiring. If it's not a fuck yes, we do close the door, I think. And it sounds a bit arrogant, but what I think I mean by that is we departed like a learning environment to start this company. We left school, both my co-founder and I really love learning, but not in an academic sense. I think we just have like this curiosity. So we wanted to surround ourselves with people who we could continue to learn from. And what we've been able to do is we find people who are compelled by the mission, which is really awesome. And a lot of times they find us and we just simply hire the most performant people that we can. I think there's a concept of the 10X engineer that's very well like popularized. I think that there are also 10X executors in other domains as well. So we've surrounded ourselves with a very lean cabinet of those people. Invaluable in terms of not only launching Fizz, but in building Fizz. We're a very small team to date. We intend to keep it that way for the time being, but we really just have a very high focus on talent density.
Last question. What are some of the spaces in consumer or fintech that you're excited to see young entrepreneurs build in?
I think that a lot of times it feels from a consumer point of view, sometimes that companies have lost the plot. And what I mean by that is some of the most successful companies that we're all aware of, like the really big and iconic ones. For example, I mean, even if we point back to, let's just say Robinhood for now, that like Robinhood's a very successful company. I think they're going to continue to become more successful. They've had their ups and downs. But if you think back to what they originally promised users, it was this core utility function that previously was just like inaccessible to them. Instantly make a free trade on your phone. It's sort of easy to see now in retrospect why that became so popular. Or with Venmo, and you think about instant payment splitting that also costs zero fees. And even built the ability to pay your rent with a credit card, which was something people could have only dreamed of before. I think that the consumer companies and the fintech companies and I guess the consumer fintech companies that need to exist are ones that are providing users functionality that previously just would have been completely unavailable to them, rather than commodifying functionalities that users could have already accessed elsewhere. I don't think that fintech companies need, I think we're past the copycat era, for lack of better phrasing there. I think that if people can create more novel financial products that give users functionality that they had been begging for, that there's alpha there. I don't necessarily think that there is alpha in building another copycat insert fintech company or traditional financial technology company here.
Well, thanks so much, Scott, for your time.
Thank you, Sammy.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Appreneurs. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and rate the episode on whatever platform you use. Next week's guest is David Pfluger, former creative director at BeReal, who shares a lot of spicy takes about brand building. If you have any guests you'd love to see on Appreneurs, leave us a comment below or message me personally